welcome, listeners, to another brand new episode of the Process Podcast. It is, of course, another sensational spectacular, and you have your hosts, Curtis Weeb and Jeremy Holt today, and we have our special guest, none other than Joe Casey, a very prolific writer who has written for near on 15 years now for many, many different titles, and he's written for Marvel, he's written for DC. Some of his titles you probably know, Uncanny X-Men and Marvel, Adventures of Superman at DC. He did a run on G.I. Joe with IDW. And as well as being a prominent writer with the Big Two, he also has a massive stack of creator-owned titles like Godland and Butcher Baker. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing tonight?
I got to lay down after the introduction. I didn't realize I'd done so much work. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was the briefest of summaries. I'm sure, you know, go to your Wikipedia article and you will be wowed by how much you've accomplished.
Eesh, no thanks.
Oh man, well, you know, we were just talking a little bit before the show started recording, and we had planned to meet up in New York, but I mean I swear you were a ghost. What was going on in New York for you this year?
Well, we met, it was kind of a drive-by meeting, if I recall.
Yeah.
Very much so.
New York was a lot busier than I thought it would be. And not just because, you know, Man of Action had a booth there, so we had to do booth time and, you know, meet the kids and all that stuff. But a lot of people that I work with were at New York. And so I found myself running around just trying to hook up with all the various artists and whatnot that I never get to hang out with, you know, and they all just happen. I mean, I always forget how big a convention New York is. So there were a lot more of my collaborators there than I ever expected there would be.
Yeah, that show was crazy. I remember I was in Artist Alley, and Jeremy was like, we got to get over to Man of Action to, you know, talk with Joe for a bit. So this was like in the middle of, like, on Saturday, oh. I think one of the busiest days. And I was in Artist Alley. I swear to God, it took me almost half an hour to get to your booth.
And was I there?
No. I was like, you know what? Screw it. We'll just talk to this guy after the con.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus.
Yeah, that was a pretty big, you know, I've never been to New York before. And Jeremy actually put me up for my stay there. I was there almost a week, and I've never walked so much. I'm fat and I'm lazy, and that was punishment.
You got used to it though.
Yeah, I did by the end, I think. But man, did you get sick as well at the end of the con, Joe?
Oh no, I've learned over many years how to avoid, you know, con crud and, you know, the con flu, and I've gotten pretty good at keeping healthy for those things.
Could you, okay, you know, I'm new to the con circuit, and maybe for any listeners out there, what are some secrets?
Don't be there as much. You know, if you're there for, you know, 6 to 8 hours inside that building, there's plenty of opportunity for germs to incubate.
Right.
But if you only go for a few hours at a time and get back outside and also, you know, plenty of hand sanitizer, that helps. And, you know, get plenty of sleep, and you got to treat it as though it's part of your working life. And
right.
You wouldn't kill yourself if you were going to an office every day. You wouldn't stay up all night and, you know, have to drag ass through a day at the office. Some people do, but it just doesn't work after a while. And besides, I'm not as young as I used to be. I can't run around like I used to.
No, that's a good point, I think, because I think everybody wants to stay up late to, you know, network and you know, go out, and you do it 3 days in a row, and then it just takes its toll.
Yeah, it's I can't do it. And I really don't. I'm sort of at that point where networking is kind of counterproductive to what I do. So it makes it easy to avoid that scene, you know, the bar con and all that stuff.
Do you remember, Joe, when you started out having to go to the cons and network, or did you approach it differently?
I did the whole bit, you know, and I was like, people thought I was on cocaine when I was at these conventions. I was so wired and, you know, just trying to soak it all in and squeeze every, you know, bit of juice out of the grape. It was insane. And I would get sick after every con. I would succumb to it all and be useless for the next week after, you know, because I just, you know, everybody goes through that phase where you kind of have to do it, you know, and you can't stop yourself because you want to take advantage of what you feel is an opportunity to talk to people or meet people. And so it's not like you know, you're not going to be sane at these things. You're just going to go for it and let the chips fall where they may, you know?
Exactly.
So how long into the process then, like you said, it's counterproductive for you now. How long did it take to get to that point? Was there like, you know, 10 years of this madness before you just realized, you know, I can't do this anymore? Or is it something that's just, you know, been like this for a while?
It wasn't quite 10 years. It was probably about 5 or 6 years into my career. And as soon as, especially at San Diego, as soon as Man of Action got really established and we had a booth every year, it sort of gave me an excuse to back off, you know, because for a while there it really did become like a job where you have to be at the booth and you have to do a lot of things that are required of you. And that's kind of eased off a little bit as the machinery of our company has kind of taken over a little bit. So we've all been able to kind of step back and not feel the compulsion to sort of be there every minute and, you know, just drive ourselves nuts. So it's been a while. And I find that the less I hang around actual humans, that the better my reputation seems to be.
That's an honest answer.
Yeah. Well, Joe, I wanted to ask you, could you tell us about how you started in comics and what was that big break for you?
Sure. I moved to Los Angeles about, I don't know, 16, 17, 18 years ago. God, 94 is when I moved to California. And I moved out here to play music. I was in a band and I wanted to get into screenwriting, but I loved comics and I'd made some sort of attempts through my teenage years to break in. And when I moved out here, I ended up meeting a lot of comic book professionals because I lived in an area that had a lot of comic book people who lived here. And even just through seeing them at the store every week that we all shopped at and kind of got to know them a little bit over a couple years. And that kind of pulled the curtain back. You know, when you sort of meet people and you see them doing the job that you would want to do or that you have an interest in doing, but you know them as sort of regular people and you're not seeing a persona. You're seeing the real person and you're seeing how they integrate their work into their life, and you see what a working professional is all about. It kind of made it a little more attainable. And so I started doing my own, you know, no money black and white comics. That's what I thought the path was supposed to be. You know, you do work for nothing, you just try to get published, try to get in print anywhere you could. In the process of that, James Robinson, who I'd known for a few years at that point, he looked at my work over the years, and for some reason he decided to give me a huge leg up and got me in at Marvel Comics. He was leaving a book he was writing, and he sort of shepherded me in before a lot of my black and white, no money work had even been printed. You know, I've been doing it, and it had existed, but it hadn't come out in the stores yet. So I actually ended up as a writer for Marvel before all of this indie work that I thought was going to sort of make my name even saw print. So I kind of did it in a sort of an ass backwards way, but certainly when I had the opportunity, I was going to take advantage of it. So once I got my foot in the door at Marvel, really, I never looked back. I just kept going. Sure. And pushing and pushing and trying to get as much work as I could. And, you know, because I never thought it would last. I thought maybe I would have, you know, a couple of months of a window to sort of get paid, get some work out there, and then go back to my no money books. But at least I'd have a couple of Marvel gigs under my belt to sort of help push the independent work out there. And as it turned out, the Marvel work and the work for company owned stuff. So I went out to DC from there, and it just never stopped, you know, and to this day has not stopped. God help me.
Well, I noticed, like, I mean, you were doing like 7 or 8 titles at a time. One of the things I was curious about, did you ever turn anything down? Or like, if they said, hey, we've got, you know, 3 titles we want you to do, were you just taking everything that came your way?
In the first couple of years of my career, I took everything. I did everything that possibly I could do. I don't remember turning anything down. The first thing I remember turning down was when the sort of editorial regime at Marvel fired my artist on my first monthly there, but they wanted me to stay. Then I didn't stay. I mean, I quit a gig. I quit jobs, but I never turned down things because I was too busy. I didn't really know the meaning of that word, too busy.
So how did you manage that workload? Like, in a given day, were you writing more than one script? You must have been.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a life. I was, you know, just writing and writing and writing. And, you know, it's kind of a setup that I use to this day. I mean, if you plan your time well and you plan your workload well enough, you can keep a lot of, you know, boats in the water. You know, you can push a lot of things along if you just do a little bit every day. And the challenge with that is to be able to change your mindset. So if you're writing, you know, whatever, the X-Men, and you write a couple of pages of that, and then you immediately shift over and you're writing Superman for a couple of pages, and you shift from that to writing some creator-owned project, and then you shift from that to whatever else. That's the agility that you need in your brain to be able to just kind of jump from from book to book or from project to project all in the same day, so that every day you're kind of chopping that tree down a little bit longer, and eventually, you know, the tree falls. You know, if you write a page a day on, you know, 6 things, then, you know, in a month you'll have 6 comics written. You know?
That's actually how you do it? Like, you actually will go, if you have enough going at the same time, you'll only write 1 or 2 pages of that specific script in a day?
Well, that's how I used to do it. Now I've gotten faster. I can write, you know, maybe 4 or 5 pages of something a day and then jump to something else. But when I really had it, you know, when I really kind of had to get a sort of a time managed thing going, that was the method that I came to. And that was, I think I only had, I had like 4 monthlies when I sort of came to that method. And now I have, I don't know, I mean, I can't even tell you what all's going on now, but it's a little more, it's a little more scattershot, but it's still that same thing of, I got to work on 6 things today, so I better, you know, have all my ducks in a row so I can just dive in and do it.
It's impressive.
Yeah, I recently switched over to writing full time, and I'm still struggling. You know, I have way more time now. I was doing about 80 hours a week between my day job and my comic writing, and I finally quit the driving. I was driving bus for a while, actually, and I was able to quit that and do writing, and I'm still, like, there are days when it's like, I got nothing done today because it gets so bogged down in all the administrative crap that, you know, it just totally ruins my mojo for my writing.
Yeah, that's become a big part of my day too, where you're just making sure everything is where it needs to be. I've gotten better at making that a minimal part of my day, but it's definitely still a part of my day, and it's the part. Sometimes it's fun because it's, you know, when you're doing, you know, a book for Image or whatever, where you shoulder a lot of the responsibility, that can also be a creative part of the process. But yeah, sometimes it's also a big fat bitch, you know?
Well, and you with, especially with Butcher Baker, you guys did that huge lead up with the teasers, and you know, there was no talk about the writer or the artist. It was just a bunch of them. Did you run that yourself, or was that everyone involved on the team?
Well, I mean, I, you know, in talking to Image with Eric Stevenson, we were talking about how to market things. How do you market things now? And the teaser thing was sort of happening, and it was mostly about having a laugh, saying, how, you know, what's the ultimate thing you can do with these teasers that is just so over the top that it's almost funny? And it was kind of funny. See, you know, it just kind of kept going, and it was kind of relentless and went for a whole month. And at the end of it, it was like, oh my God. I mean, the people that stuck with it, the websites that stuck with it, and I give them a lot of credit, but it was, at the time, it was like, this is just a big joke. It was just a big piece of performance art in and of itself. And it wasn't so much, for me, it wasn't so much about, wow, this is going to be great promotion for my book. It was more like, this is going to be fun to watch people's, you know, reactions to this, you know. And they ran the gamut, that's for sure. And then, you know, once the book, the details of the book and who's working on it gets announced, I'm pleased that people still remember that that's how we launched it. You know, that's how we announced it, with this month-long campaign.
So do you think it actually benefited your sales, or was it more just it got a lot of press for it?
I have no idea if it benefited the sales. Maybe a little bit, but, you know, as you know, at Image, those margins are so small that, you know, I mean, maybe, okay, so you could say the teaser campaign maybe gave us a bump of like 1,000 in, you know, initial orders, maybe. That's that's nothing to sneeze at when it comes to an Image comic, but it's still like, you know, that's not moving the needle too much. But like I said, that's not why I did it. I did it because I thought it would be fun, and I wanted to see it. No one else had done it. And, you know, sometimes you see the mountain and you just climb it. You don't really think about why you're climbing, because it's there is the only reason to do it, you know?
Yeah. So Joe, how do you manage your time as far as Butcher Baker? Because obviously with an Image book, the creators, you know, as you said, shoulder a lot of the responsibility. How much input are you having other than just writing the scripts and sending them over to Mike?
I have input on the whole thing, really. You know, I mean, Mike and I, it's very collaborative. Once the script is done, you know, we talk about how to approach it, and that's really just in terms of storytelling. Once we kind of nail down the storytelling aspect of it, I just let him go to town, because we knew going in what kind of book it was going to be and the experimental nature of it, and I wanted Mike to push himself and, you know, just feel that freedom to approach any scene in whatever manner he sort of had the inspiration to do, you know. I mean, and the scripts do not indicate like, okay, this one is going to be duotone, or this scene is going to be, you know, some other weird kind of way. Sometimes I'll kind of say, hey, you know, let's go for something kind of psychedelic here. That's kind of the extent of my direction in terms of his art. I'm more concerned with the storytelling itself. Once we sort of get that straight, I just let him go off, and you know, I'm just as excited as hopefully the readers are by what comes back. You know, I just get the privilege of seeing it first.
Yeah, like that's the art on that is gorgeous, but it looks quite different from a lot of this other stuff that he's done. It looks like he's experimenting a lot with the title.
Well, when we first started talking about it, I'd known him for a few years, and we'd worked on one little thing together, and but I'd seen like his sketchbooks and things, and seen where, when left to his own devices, how nutty he could go. And I said, you know, that's the stuff that I want in this book. Let's, you know, take everything that you do and put it in one place, and I'll come up with something that's kind of crazy enough and wacky enough to contain all those approaches, and it won't seem out of place. So the content matched the approach and the ways that he was able to draw and the ways he came to it. The fact that he was coloring it himself made a big difference. He could have that total control. And, you know, I think the the idea behind the book and the concept and the story is wacky enough that everything that he tries just seems to fit, you know. There's nothing that he can do that's going to be like, oh, this doesn't work for this book. I mean, everything that he got is going to work for this weird, you know.
Were you was this story written before you approached him, or did you design some of the characters inspired by some of the stuff he'd been drawing?
I had a rough idea of the setup about the retired superhero who was brought back to blow up the supervillain prison, and some of them get out and go after him. And then I think I had the idea for the cop, for the Willard character. But that was just, I just had that framework. And then once it was going to be Mike drawing it, then we came up with the characters and fleshed things out a bit more. And because I knew that he could pull it off. I mean, the absolutely was not in my original idea, but once it was going to be Mike as the artist, I'd had that idea for that character for, I don't know, something else, I think. And I said, well, I can put that in here because I know Mike can pull it off. So it's all kind of I'm pulling from all kinds of things. And, it, you know, I knew that this particular project was going to be this kind of weird, wacky stew that you could just kind of throw anything in and it was going to fit somehow.
Nice. One of the things I was curious about, and I saw your Man of Action booth. So you're busy writing all these other projects and then you get involved with Man of Action. I know that's, you guys have developed Ben 10 and a couple other, you know, things for Cartoon Network. Yeah. What was the origin of that? I know you guys are all kind of have worked together. You're friends. What was the idea that brought that studio together?
I think that it was, we'd worked together on the X-Men books first and, you know, just got to know each other and got to be friends. And myself and Steve and Duncan, we all live in L.A. So I had actually known them just as I was becoming a professional and probably a little bit before. And then we all met Joe, who lives in New York, through working on the X-Men books. And then we all kind of migrated over to the Superman books. And we just were good friends, you know. And I think one of the first things that we did that necessitated working together as a group is that when I was writing the X-Men, they'd come to me to write, Activision come to me to write this video game, this X-Men video game. And, to be honest, I don't have a lot of interest in writing video games. And it was a huge project. So I pulled in, you know, these guys to help me, and that gig helped solidify the company. And so we did that gig together, and that sort of made our name or whatever. And then it wasn't long after that we went and as that same group started pitching the Cartoon Network, and that's, you know, we sold Ben 10, and then it just kind of went on from there.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, like I've seen you guys around, and it seems like you guys all have, you know, there's a real camaraderie there. I think that's I'm definitely jealous of you having that kind of connection with other creators, and that's one of the great things about comics, I think, is there is kind of that sense of community that, you know, we were just talking to Scott Snyder the other day, and we were talking about writing like short stories or novels and stuff like that. It's very insular, but comics, it's all about the collaboration, and that's definitely one of the things that I enjoy about it.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, the Man of Action thing, we're kind of like, this is my background, so this is where I go. We're kind of like a band that hasn't kicked any members out yet, you know. And there are those bands that last, you know. And at this point, being, you know, 10, 11 years into it, I'm sort of curious how long it will last, you know. Because if you think about it, it's also like with a successful band, like I was saying before, the machinery of it sort of takes over. It's not just four guys in a garage. You have, you know, when you start making money and you start having long-term gigs that you're responsible for, and you start taking on, employees, essentially, it threatens to become bigger than you are. So the struggle is always to remember, well, it's the four of us, and this is what it's about, and not let the bigness of it start to take over. And it's a challenge. It's a real challenge.
How much of your day does Mad of Action generally take up? Is it something you just, that's more administrative, or are you still doing a lot of pitching and writing and a lot of your day as part of that company?
It's taken up a lot of time because we work now as producers on something like the Spider-Man animated series that's coming out next year. That is a very day-in, day-out process. I mean, we run the writing on that show. So we're doing outlines, or we're going to production meetings, or we're, you know, rewriting a script, or, you know, it becomes an endless kind of thing. Now, being, you know, coming from a freelance mindset, which I was in for, you know, many, many years, I'm still used to that relentless pace, but now it's on different kinds of projects as opposed to strictly comics, which is, you know, I would love to just still be writing comics exclusively, but it's hard to, you know, you can only go so far in that field where you're just, I couldn't be doing, you know, 20 comics a month. I mean, you know, there wasn't enough work out there to keep me occupied, you know. So the Man of Action thing, I think for all of us, is a way to progress in our work life and find new areas to explore and new kinds of creativity, you know. I mean, I like to look at it that way. I don't want it to just seem like, oh, we're, you know, a big sort of corporate machine ourselves now, and we're just going to give ourselves over to the meat grinder. That would be quite sad, I think.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I've noticed a lot of the creators now, I'd say in the last 5 years or so, or even 10 years, you know, they've come through as groups. Like, they've had friends, and it's good to have those friends, and it's good to have that small network that you can trust and use as a sounding board for ideas. Have you thought about, you know, how influential your friendships have been in regards to your work, opposed to someone trying to do it all on their own and trying to break in and all that?
Well, I suppose it's had an effect. I mean, it's, to me, it's always that tension of, you know, being part of a group and being a, you know, sort of a functioning member of society, basically, but also trying to maintain my cult iconoclastic status that I've worked so hard to, you know, engender the past 10 years or so. It's hard to sort of rail against the man when in some respects you are the man. But I will continue to do it, continue to indulge in that tension as long as I can get away with it. So yeah, I mean, it's, and certainly, you know, it's, I don't think anyone, this is pretty transparent that the success of something like a Ben 10 certainly allows a cushion for me to strike out in something like comic books in a direction that maybe I wouldn't be able to afford to strike out in if I was based, you know, if I didn't have that success. You know what I mean? It's definitely a buffer to allow me to do a lot more creator-owned work than I would normally afford to be able to do, you know?
Sure. So sorry, Curtis. I was curious about your average day. Like, an average day as Joe Casey, writer extraordinaire, what is an average day for you?
Well, there's two. I have two typical days. One is having a day full of, you know, driving to meetings and having to deal with sort of the Man of Action side of things. That's a typical day where I'll, you know, spend, you know, a lot of time in the car driving all over Los Angeles to make it to meetings with various people that we're in various stages of business relationships with. That's one kind of day. Then I have the days where I, you know, I push everything aside and I get to sit and write and just work on the stuff that, in a purely creative sense. And that's just what I was describing before, where you're just, you know, spending an hour or two working on one thing, and then you move on to something else, and spend an hour or two on that, and you move on to something else, and you're just jumping from project to project. When I can get a full day of that, that's my favorite way to spend my time, you know. And so I kind of, it's more of a struggle to have those days now than it used to be.
But so when you actually do get the opportunity to have a day where you can just sit down and focus on your projects. Now, obviously we're a writing podcast, and one of the things that we like to talk to is the actual process behind it. How would you describe your actual process when you have an idea, from that point of having the idea for a story until you actually write your first issue?
Well, I learned a method from Steve Siegel, which is basically it's an outlining method, which is taking a piece of legal pad or whatever, piece of notebook paper that's already, you know, ruled with lines, and you number the lines 1 through 20 or 1 through 22 or whatever the page count is for that issue, and you basically break down the story. You know, each line represents a page, and you're, for me, I'm actually, because I'm thinking, you know, visually, as you do in comics, I'm literally writing down line by line what's happening in each panel, you know, close up here, followed by a wide shot where this is happening. And so once that outline is done, on one piece of paper, I have the whole comic, I have the whole shape of the comic that I can look at, and then it's just working from that outline, typing it up, you know, as a Word document or whatever on the computer. And so a typical day might be I'll spend, you know, an hour or two outlining, you know, half of an issue of, you know, whatever, Butcher Baker or, you know, Haunt or Vengeance or whatever the fuck I'm working on at the time. So I'll have that, and then I'll move on to working on another book where I have the whole outline done. So I'm just referring to the outline and sort of typing shit into the computer, and I'll do like 5 or 6 pages of that. And then move on to something where I haven't even outlined it yet. I'm just still conceptualizing things and just kind of writing down notes in a notebook and, you know, just kind of letting your imagination go and seeing where it'll take you. And that is usually the fun part, where it's a completely blank canvas and you're just letting your mind go and seeing what you come up with. Now, I don't let that go on for too long, because I also like sort of the automatic writing of it all, where you're really creating at the speed of thought. And something that comes up in your brain, either I'll write something down and let it sit for, you know, months and then come back to it and sort of revisit it, or I'll come up with something, write it down, and it goes right in the outline. I don't even think too long or hard about it. And it's kind of a game that you can play with yourself. You think, how well crafted can I do something that I just thought of in a spontaneous moment? You know, can I write it and put it out in the world and make it not seem like I just thought of it 2 seconds ago?
Yeah, totally.
Do you have an example of that, of something that worked?
I don't know. Every issue of Butcher Baker, every issue of Vengeance.
Nice.
It's every issue of Godland is kind of like that, or has been like that. Officer Down was like that. Charlatan Ball was completely spontaneous improv writing, you know.
So, Joe, when you're outlining, because I actually do something similar where I do note 22 pages or whatever, and most of the heavy lifting is in that outline. But what about for you as far as dialogue from that scripting standpoint? Do you just write the dialogue as you're typing it up, typing up the outline and fleshing it out, or do you sit and do dialogue separately?
I don't know if I've ever said this publicly how I do it, but I'll type up the whole script with no dialogue. It's all panel descriptions, because I'm sort of carrying it over from the outline and making it readable and, you know, decipherable for an artist or an editor. and I do the whole script. And it's so you know, if you at that stage, it's like it's the whole script, all the panels. I could send that to an artist and he could draw it. There just would be no dialogue. Occasionally I'll throw in some dialogue as I'm doing that because something will come to me, or I know I want to have a certain moment, or maybe it's in the outline. I kind of jotted down a phrase or a piece of dialogue that I thought of at the time. But for the most part, I try to save it so that I do strictly a dialogue pass, where I can go to a script and all I'm doing is dialogue. I don't have to worry about panel descriptions or any kind of exposition. I'm just letting the characters talk. And it can be spontaneous. Again, I'm just looking for that spontaneity so it doesn't feel like such a mechanical thing. I want it to be as fun for me and as inspiring for me as I'm doing it as hopefully it will be for the readers. I really believe that energy can translate. If you know, got a kick out of writing the thing, hopefully somebody will get a kick out of reading it. And if you had a miserable time writing it, it's hard to imagine that someone reading it isn't going to have just miserable of a time, you know?
Right.
So I do everything that I can to protect the process so that it's never miserable when it counts, if that makes any sense.
No, totally.
Have you always written it that way, or is that something you learned later on?
I had to learn that because, you know, over, you know, 13, 14 years of doing this, you know, there were periods where it got to be a slog, a real slog, where I just, you know, you wonder, why the hell am I doing this? You know, what is my life? You know, and that, you have those kind of, you know, staring at yourself in the mirror moments, you know, wondering what happened. And you know, in those moments, you have to, you know, sort of dig down and find it. And, you know, it's, you know, writing comics is the greatest job in the world, but it can still be a very daunting profession from a, you know, you're still having to be creative on a pretty regular basis, and that can wear you down after a while. And then, you know, you find yourself, you know, where you've taken a job like writing, you know, fucking G.I. Joe or whatever, and you're like, how did I get it? You know, and you have to, and all you can do is write your way out of it. That's all you can do, is write your way out of it and hope that when you come out the other side, you're not completely burnt out and that you can, you know, you can get it up again for the next one, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever come to a place where you haven't, like you've had like a month or two where there was nothing, you were just done?
I don't think so. I don't recall ever being so burnt out, because what you do along the way is you have those tricks or those things that you go to that can kind of re-inspire you, whether it's certain movies or music or, you know, comics from your childhood or current comics that are out there. There's enough things that you can, that I find that are available that can sort of reignite the spark. You just got to find the right thing in the right moment. You know, something that inspires you on a Tuesday, you might look at on Friday and it does nothing for you. It doesn't get those juices flowing. So you have to be fairly adept at going, okay, I know what I need to inspire me right now. I know what I need to go to, whether it's old David Michelinie Avengers comics or watching, you know, Apocalypse Now on DVD, or, you know, listening to a certain album or whatever it is. You have to know yourself well enough and kind of know where you are in your own creative headspace to be able to find the right tool for the right job, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about the spontaneity of writing dialogue, because that totally translates in Butcher Baker, because I feel like, you know, I do read some comics where the dialogue feels very crafted and it feels like it's been, you know, redone. So it's like perfect. But it does lose some character to it. But everything, every time I would flip a page in Butcher Baker, it would just make me laugh, because it's like, did he just think of that just now? And it feels like that because it's just so in the moment, which is really, really awesome.
That's usually the case, that I thought of it right then and there. And if it feels right after I thought of it, I go with it. You know. Now, the danger of that is you can tend to forget what you've written. You know, I don't remember writing certain things. I don't. There are whole issues of Godland I don't remember writing. And they just exist now. And I mean, I used to be really, I was, you know, in the first couple of years of my career, I was pretty good at keeping track of what I'd written and when I'd written it, and you know, just the whole process from start to finish. And then at some point, it all becomes a goddamn blur. And I look back on things, whole series I've written, and I'm like, where the hell did that come from? And how did I do that? You know, I look at something like, you know, The Intimates, and I just think, God, at what point did I work that hard on something to cram that much stuff into it? But it only feels like hard work in retrospect. At the time, I was just doing what I was doing, and now I probably, my comics are probably just as dense, but I've built those muscles up to where it doesn't seem like such a workout anymore. You know, I'd put Butcher Baker or Godland up to anything that I'd done in the past that seemed really dense and really work intensive. And there, you know, it's just as intensive to me.
So you were talking earlier about getting certain, a different muse for different projects. What was something like, what were you listening to when you wrote, your newest independent, Butcher Baker? Was there a musical score that helped you get that process flowing?
Trying to think. I don't know if there was a lot of, I don't know, maybe at some point I was probably calling up some old Jerry Reed tunes, you know, for Butcher Baker. That would probably be obvious to anyone who's read it. I don't know. It's funny that I haven't had that kind of writer's block in a while, so I don't think I've had to go to anything specifically to get me charged up, you know. If anything, I've been more willing to just let it come from my own, you know, the depths of my black heart, as opposed to looking for some outside inspiration, because I'm kind of curious to see what happens if I just, you know, sort of mine the depths of my own soul and see what comes out, if that makes any sense. That's kind of a heavy-handed way of saying it. But, you know, there are influences that are sort of part of my DNA that are going to come out, and they're all over Butcher Baker, you know, that kind of mid-80s, you know, renaissance of superhero comics that happened. I mean, that is Butcher Baker's, you know, ancestry all over. But it's not like I had copies of anything sitting on my desk when I was writing Butcher Baker. I just assumed that if I dig deep enough, that stuff will be unearthed and just it'll just come out. But if I'm depending on my own memories of things, and hopefully it's coming out in a somewhat original way, I'm not just lifting things. And I mean, I'm not above and certainly not beyond the scratch mix method of writing, where you're just taking things from everywhere and just throwing it in there. But I tend to depend on my own memories of things and my perceptions of things, my impressions of things that I read or that I listened to or that I watched, rather than pulling them out and having them right in front of my face. You know, I think there's a difference.
Yeah, I think that also, you know, we were having this, obviously, the same conversation with Scott Snyder earlier about the process of writing. And I think both of you, you have dynamically different ways of writing, but you've honed and perfected a process of scripting that doesn't feel like work. And it doesn't cage you in any way or make it feel more complicated than it has to be when you know, let these things happen. Like you said, your experiences just kind of bleed onto the page. And I think that's really important for people who want to write in any medium, is to really, you know, learn how to get the process going that works for you, basically.
Yeah, I think that hopefully you know, the best writers are process junkies themselves, you know, and I certainly was, or at least you go through that phase of being a process junkie. And I certainly the first 5 years of my career as a professional, I would switch up my writing methods or my formats or anything. I remember I wrote all of the second volume of Wildcats, not 3.0, but the one, the version I did with Sean Phillips. I wrote all of those scripts longhand in notebooks. And wow. Because I thought that, well, if I wrote them out longhand, something would come out of that. Something interesting would come out of that process. And I could write anywhere. And it seemed, I mean, it was a crude method, but I just, that was what I was into at that moment. And of course, once I finished that, and I was like, goddamn, I'm never going to write that way again. Because you burn through these things, right? I would see, like, when I first started writing for Marvel, I wrote in the James Robinson script template because that's the way he wrote, and I was sort of taking over him, and I didn't want to just advertise the fact that it wasn't James writing these scripts anymore. So if I figured if it looked the same, then, you know, I was halfway there. And so that's how I wrote it first. And then, you know, after a while I was like, okay, I'll write this way now. And I maybe had seen somebody else's script template and I just switched over to that. And then, you know, at this point I just kind of have my own sort of bastardized version of all the things that I'd tried over the years. But I think for new writers, that's an important part of the process, is to try different methods and try different approaches and see what fits. And sometimes the approach can inform the work in some way. And I kind of feel like that longhand method of writing that I did for Wildcats Volume 2 informed that work in some way, you know, and who knows if it did, but it did for me. And in a way, that's all that matters. It's what you need to, you know, get you through the night, really.
Yeah, and I think it's, well, you said you definitely remember writing at the longhand, so it's something that clearly sticks out in your mind. And, you know, obviously you learned a lesson from doing it that way that clearly was, you know, a little more extensive than necessary. You know, I've kind of been using the same scripting method since I started. When I first started reading comics, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago, I looked into the Dark Horse. They had a sample script there, and they had this certain layout, and I've used that ever since, and it's just how I've always gone. And I mean, I've never actually gone back to, you know, maybe readjusted. I've seen so many different types of scripting, but, you know, this one's always worked for me, so I haven't had a need to change it so far anyway.
Yeah, if it works, it works. And I think the reason I switched up a lot early on is that I had such an anxiety about getting stale for myself. I didn't want to burn out. I was doing so much work that I didn't want to burn out on any level. So I would switch things up just to keep it interesting for myself, you know. And believe me, that's a mind game that only an insane person would play with themselves, probably.
No, it's valid though, because I looked at some of the early versions of scripts that I wrote. I mean, the first thing that I ever showed anyone was I showed a editor at Vertigo this script that I wrote, and it read like a screenplay. It looked like a screenplay, and I knew nothing about comic book scripts. And I looked up, you know, Jason Aaron's format. I looked up Joshua Dicer's format, and both of those guys I really liked. So I kind of made my own that, you know, progressed and sped up my work process. But I mean, you're right. You really have to look at the mechanics of all of this. It's not just, you know, coming up with cool ideas and having someone draw it. I mean, it's technical, which I don't think people think about.
And I think that's the right, what you just said. I mean, you saw the script formats of guys that you liked and guys that whose writing you liked. And sometimes that's enough to sort of kick you into that mode. You know, it's you're fooling yourself because everybody writes the way they write. You can't, just because you write in somebody's format isn't going to put you, you know, you're not going to write like them. But I do think it can kick you into a certain mindset. Now, I mean, now that I think about it, I think the reason that I wrote the Wildcat stuff longhand is because I found out that that was how Garth Ennis wrote his scripts. And I was going, and I wanted, and I admired that kind of, his scripts have a real terseness to them, even in the panel descriptions. And I think that probably came from writing them out longhand. You're not going to write Alan Moore style scripts when you're doing it longhand. Your hand would fall off. So that type of writing brings with it a terseness, and I wanted that in the Wildcat stuff. So I think that was my link, you know. And of course, once I started doing it, I wrote like me. I couldn't get away from that. But in my head, I felt like it was at least putting me in that mindset, you know. Probably didn't work, but you know.
So when you actually sit down to write something, are you a person that likes to listen to music? Do you need a quiet space? Do you go to the library or a cafe? What kind of things do you need for your environment?
I tend to just need a nice chunk of time. It doesn't have to be quiet or anything like that. I need time where I feel like I don't have to go and do something in an hour. I don't like the anxiety of you only have, you know, 2 hours to do this, so you better make it count. It's the hardest part about, you know, growing up basically and becoming an adult is that you don't have just that sense of endless free time to just think about things and, you know, have a fucking complete thought, you know, about anything. I really miss that, you know, and I think that I never really thought about, I mean, I'm admittedly a workaholic. I fully own up to that. And I would hear about other people. I'd be like, you hear about people retiring. I'd think, retire? What the fuck do you want to retire for? Sit on your porch and watch the grass grow or whatever? What is this retire bullshit? Now I'm starting to kind of see the appeal of not having, you know, 12 deadlines hanging over your head every day, you know, and it doesn't mean you stop, but you can morph into maybe a more relaxed way of doing things, you know. And I used to really push myself because I thought if I slowed down the momentum at all, then I would just lose it completely. You know, it's like you're gripping the wheel so tight because you feel like if you relax at all, that there are 10 other guys who are gripping the wheel just as tight that'll just zoom right ahead of you.
No, totally.
Yeah, and I've just kind of – it takes effort to back off from that stance, you know, to sort of let yourself kind of relax a little bit and or at least plan ahead so that you can at some point find that open-endedness again. Because there's a certain type of creativity that comes from deadlines and really sort of bearing down and having to push through it. That's one kind of creativity. But there's certainly another kind that comes from just easing up and taking a fucking long breath and, you know, letting it happen. And, you know, I mean, it's – and letting it go and not feeling – and not being so crazed and anxious about it, you know.
Even with your grueling pace and, you know, you've admitted being a workaholic, how do you balance the rest of your personal life and friends and time that isn't devoted to working or writing?
I don't. No, there is no balance. I mean, it's
because I mean, the reason I brought it up because Jason Aaron has this blog on CBR and he talked about balance. And he said that the day that he got his own office, because he has a wife and kids and, you know, the day he got his own office was the real day he could balance his writing between that and his personal life. And he'd asked a bunch of his writer friends how they balanced. And they said, you know, once they got their own space, they could dedicate that time and that space to work. And once they left that space, they could focus on the rest of their life. But I didn't know if all writers try to, you know, strive to do that or if they just have their own methods.
I don't know about other guys. I mean, I have to say for myself, because of the way I write and I try to write very personally, even if it's a work for hire gig, I try to put as much of myself into the work as I can. Because if I'm going to spend all this time doing it, it's got to be more than just accomplishment of craft. It has to be more than just hey, I hit my deadline and now it's going to come out and everyone will get their dose of, you know, Iron Man having his adventures or whatever. It's got to mean more. So if it's going to mean more, then that means you can't shut your office door and shut your life out. It comes in with you. And it informs the work, and in some ways it infects the work. And so I don't have that compartmentalization that maybe other guys do. And God bless them, you know. But it just doesn't work like that for me, because it's, if I'm just executing some stupid story about a superhero who puts on his costume and fights the bad guy, and I've satisfied my editor and satisfied a publisher's needs, if that's all that it is, then it's not worth doing, because I've done that. You know, once you're in the game long enough and you've written the big franchise characters and you've, you know, I mean, once you've kind of done it all, or you feel like you've done it all, but there, you still have to do it, you got to find new ways of doing it, you know? And for me, totally. it's been about letting my life into my work in a big way. And so the things that are, even the work for hire jobs that I've done in the past couple of years, there's a lot of my own dysfunction, a lot of my own anxieties, and a lot of my own experiences that enter into that work. And for me, it makes it more meaningful, but it also makes life a little more chaotic than maybe one would want it to be. Because I have this theory about writing comics in particular, is that when people first get into writing comics, and maybe you guys can speak to this, but it certainly was like this for me, you get in, even though you might be writing superheroes or imaginative stuff, you still have this need for it to be, you know, realistic and really, you know, feel like real life and have some grit to it. Even if you're writing the Justice League of America or whatever, you want it to seem real, because you're trying to create reality on some level. Because usually people are starting this career at a time in their life when they're relatively young, probably not married, don't have a lot of responsibilities. So, you know, your life is fairly easygoing. So you look for some reality in the fictions that you're creating. Well, okay, so you do that for a while, and then you go on and your life progresses, and maybe you do get married, and then you have some kids, and your responsibilities really start to come into play in your life. So the writing tends to take a turn. Mine did, to a much more escapist kind of writing, because the last thing you want to do is have realism in your writing, because you're dealing with it in your day-to-day life, you know? You're dealing with right. mortgages and, you know, wives or girlfriends or kids or just drama, you know, the drama of being an adult human being. So the writing for me tends to go more towards the fantastical and the surreal. I mean, my writing got really surreal when real life really started to bear down on me. And now I've sort of come out the other side. I found this balance where I can let real life, at least the emotions of it, inform the writing, but yet I can still get my rocks off with this kind of improvisational, off-the-cuff, you know, psychedelic kind of writing, which I've been doing the past couple of years. So it's this weird blend of the grittiness of real life, but it comes out more emotionally than just, hey, I'm going to have this superhero, you know, have a drug problem or, you know, have some kind of real-world problem. It's more about the tone of it that feels real, but the content is still as cracked out as I can possibly make it, you know. And that balance is just, you know, how I get through each day doing this work.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, it's insightful, because you know, I'm relatively young, I suppose, and anybody at this point in comic books trying to get in has to come up with something creator-owned. They've got to pitch their own book. They have to get it printed, because I'm not going to be pitching to the big two anytime soon. And, you know, it's nice to hear another writer who, you know, takes his work personally, but in a way where he goes at this grueling pace, because, you know, I've been traveling down that road, and a lot of other things in my life have kind of fallen by the wayside, and it just makes me think, is this worth it? Am I doing the right thing? But, you know, at the end of the day, this is what gets me up in the morning. So it's nice to know that there are other people that kind of go at it head first, and you know, so.
Listen, this isn't, you know, comic books is an art form, and we are creative artists. And, you know, as such, even though you have to bear in mind, you know, be professional, you know, hit your deadlines, all that stupid shit, that is part of it. We can never forget that, you know, we're artistic souls, you know, and that is not a normal point of view for most human beings. We are weird motherfuckers for doing that. But we have to indulge it, you know. I mean, it's,
yeah.
There's no, you know, I know that especially, you know, when you're trying to break in or trying to sort of climb the ladder, you protect yourself with that veneer of professionalism. You say, look, I'm not going to make any kind of weird human mistakes, and hopefully that'll help me advance my career. And it does, believe me. But there's a wildness to what we do and a creative anarchy to what we do that you always have to indulge in. You always have to let that thing go and let it be there and don't suppress it. Now, that doesn't mean when you meet an editor at a convention that you're going to, you know, like do some weird dance and put gum in his hair to like show how what a wacky creative type you are. But
you should let the work show for it.
Exactly. I mean, it should be there in the work, you know, and, you know, I hesitate sometimes to tell that to people who are just starting out because you can take it too far and alienate the people you're trying to sell to or to market to or to collaborate with or, you know, whatever. But being on this side of it, man, it's so important. And I probably lost myself at times in my early career trying to be Mr. Professional because I really thought I never really thought I was a guy that had a whole lot of natural talent and natural ability. But I thought, well, if I was the hardworking guy, Mr. Professional, then that would overcome a lot of my deficiencies in the talent department. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now I've realized everybody has talent. Everybody, it's just about finding your voice. You know, don't ever think that if you have the balls to commit it to paper, then you already have enough talent to do it. You just have to find your voice so that what you do is unique and individual to you, and that the networking side of it and the ladder climbing side of it is all about learning how to market your voice. It's not about getting the job and proving that you can do the job. You know, you know, that's nothing to prove. You can do the job. Everyone who's gotten to the point that you guys have has proven that you can do the job. Now it's just about how you do the job. And that's what you're marketing. You're saying, you know, even when it's a work for hire gig, you're saying, look, you can get 10 assholes to write this Iron Man story, but nobody's going to write it like I can write it. And that's what you're marketing. That's what you're putting out there in the world. Because in the work for hire game, it is all about, it's this weird mixture of conformity and individuality. Because you want to, you know, you want to let your prospective employers know that, yeah, I can play the game just like any other dickhead that's going to, you're going to meet. However, I play the game in a way that you're never going to find anywhere else. If you like the way I play the game, then we can do business.
Do you like one or the other? I mean, working for the big two or doing creator-owned books, do you favor one or the other?
To me, I'm so in love with writing comics that I'll take them both on with sort of equal joy.
Yeah.
And at this point, you know, anyone who's kind of looked at my work for hire stuff over the past couple of years, it's certainly had its own, you know, individualistic nature to it. You know, I mean, I'm not, my work for hire stuff hasn't been you know, I'm not going to be writing the Captain America comic, you know, monthly anytime soon. You know, that's not where my head is at. But I will write, you know, I'll write Vengeance because I can do whatever the fuck I want, basically. And I'll write Haunt because that's an opportunity to kind of follow a certain kind of muse. You know, and if anything, that's what, you know, going on 15 years has earned me, is the room to do work for hire stuff, but still apply my own voice to it, you know? And I feel like I've worked my ass off to get to that point. And it's had a lot to do with, you know, how I've cultivated myself in the press and how I market myself and all that kind of bullshit that is sort of attendant to this kind of work. Because, you know, it's all showbiz, baby. But I've used that showbiz to be able to do the kind of work that I want to do. And I've turned myself into a type of commodity that I am able to sell, and not just in a creator-owned venue, but to the big companies too, you know. And look, it doesn't always work. I certainly won't be working for DC Comics anytime soon. But at the same time, I'm able to go over to Marvel and occasionally do a thing over there where I can proudly stand behind it and say, hey, yeah, I'm working, you know, at the biggest comic publisher in the world, but I'm doing it pretty much on my own terms, you know. And not a lot of people can say that. Even some of the biggest writers you can name are not working completely on their own terms, you know. So, you know, I stand behind my career because I've gotten to that place.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, definitely. Obviously, you're, you know, what you've worked so hard for. I mean, that the reward is what you're seeing now. I mean, that's got to make it all worthwhile, right?
I hope so. Fuck, man.
I guess we're coming up to the end here. One of the last things I wanted to ask you is, you know, we've talked about your experiences and where you've come from, and, you know, just now summarizing where you're at with your career now, what are some of the things that you could say to other writers out there just starting out or who are maybe a year or two into their careers? What are some things that they can avoid that will save them a lot of pain down the road?
That's a good question, you know. I would say, I mean, it's a lot of what I just said. I mean, everybody has a voice. Everybody has their own voice. And, you know, at a certain stage in your career, maybe it's not quite developed. But I would say, as you're doing all the things, I mean, everybody kind of knows what to do. I mean, you guys are doing it. You know, you're pitching things. You're hooking up with artists. You're cultivating creator-owned projects. And, you know, it's you guys are doing all the right things. And within that, just make sure that you stay in touch with the thing that is uniquely you, you know. I know, Curtis, you've got some things out, you know, through Image. And when you do those things for Image, I know that part of that process is, okay, what is a cool concept that maybe no one has thought of yet? You know, you're looking for that hook, because that's what sells the project when it's, you know, a writer that not many people have read yet or an artist that not many people are familiar with. So you look for that hook. And that's, I'd say that's important, but that hook is only part of it, you know. It's also your voice, you know. That's the best way to say it. So while you're doing all these things, I say this to any new writer out there, while you're doing all these things that make professional sense and make career sense, always keep that little piece in there that is uniquely you. And if you have that, you know, it's like that urge or that little voice inside you that says, listen, just play the game. Don't go too far with what, you know, with your voice or the thing that you like about your own writing or the thing that you feel is unique about yourself. Don't suppress that just for the sake of, you know, advancing your career, because the danger is you suppress those things to the point where you finally get the career, but then you have lost the thing that you can offer to the world as an artist. You know, you've clamped it down so much just to play the game to get the jobs, that once you get into the position where you're like, okay, now I have some breathing room, now I can really do some good work, and then you look inside yourself and you go, well, where's the thing that, where am I now? You spent so much time constructing the professional writer that you beat out your amateur status to a point where it's detrimental to the work. You know, I proudly hold on to my amateur status as a writer because that's the thing that only I can provide. You know, that's the thing that makes me unique as a writer and an artist or whatever you want to call it. And so don't get so caught up in the game of getting to where you want to get to and getting to where you think you need to be that you're not true to who you are, you know. And that is fucking a long-winded way of saying just be true to yourself. Just be true to yourself as a writer, even when the construct of the business makes it seem like you should abandon that and just kind of fall in line with, well, these other guys did it this way, so I should do it that way. Fuck that noise, you know. That's not the way to go. You know, be who you are and learn how to market yourself in a professional way, but never in a way that's not authentic to who you are, you know?
That's really, really solid advice. I don't know, Jeremy, do you have any final questions before we wrap up the show?
No, I just want to, you know, obviously thank you for taking the time out. I also want to thank you for sending that email to us a few weeks back. For people who don't know, Joe wrote us a really glowing email about the show and about, you know, what we're trying to kind of shed some light on. So I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, I mean, I said it in the email. This, I think what you guys are doing with this podcast is important. And it's, you know, the Hollywoodization of comics has really, it's really a shame that it loses that, this sort of nuts and bolts conversation. It doesn't happen often enough because everyone wants to buy into the glamour of this profession, and it has its own glamour. If you're into, you know, if you're a fan of comics and you like this world, there is a bit of glamour to it and a bit of glitz to it. It's fun. It should be. It's a fun profession. But I hate to think that the artistic nature of it gets lost because everyone's trying to be so sort of hip and cool and wow, look at my Hollywood option and look at, you know, this sort of variant cover artist that I've gotten to do this thing, and everyone wants to look so slick and so professional that there is, you know, you lose the meat of it, you know. And I feel like you guys are willing to talk about the meat of it, and that's something that isn't getting out there enough. So I, you know, that's why I, you know, wrote that MASH note, because I just thought this is important shit to be talking about, you know, and it's good that there's sort of a group of you talking about it, because, you know, this is just stuff that when I was starting out, you just, you know, and certainly when I was a kid and starting to think about writing for a living and being creative for a living, you just didn't have this kind of access to just honest conversation. So that's where I think the value of this lies. So just, you know, I would just say keep pushing this thing out there and letting more people know that you guys are having these conversations and that it's, you know, it's definitely worth doing.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, man. It's something that we, you know, we talked about back in early spring, and I just thought, you know, I had never seen anything like it out there, and it'd just be really interesting to talk with other people and just record them. Actually, it was just kind of a conversation, and it led into this podcast. So yeah, I'm glad I did it, because we're talking to people like you, we're talking to all these other different writers that we all admire, and read their work, and it's a really awesome opportunity, and it's really accessible. So yeah, I'm really happy with the podcast.
Good. Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll wrap up there. Thanks again, Joe, for coming on and talking to us in this last hour and a bit. We really appreciate you taking the time and giving us some really interesting insights into your career and your experiences. We want to also thank Image Addiction for hosting the show. And just like always, we will have our regular episodes coming up as well as these specials. So stay tuned to our podcast, and we will keep interesting content coming your way. Talk again very soon.